Time to take a look at the wonderful world of insects here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to WPR News. We can talk with you today about cicadas or pollinating butterflies or spongy moths or whatever else insect-wise is on your mind with our guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He was also going to talk about a citizen science project today as well. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got a cicada memory to share with us. Maybe you got a question about an insect that you're curious about, or maybe one that may be causing some issues. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. PJ, good to see you again.
It's good to be here with you, Larry.
Let's talk spongy moths just to begin. How bad is this summer's outbreak of spongy moths?
Yeah, it's been bad in some areas. And this is something that myself and colleagues, both at UW and in agencies like DNR and DATCAP, have been keeping a close eye on, because the populations of this invasive insect have really built up now over the course of several years because of some of the dry weather we've had, especially last year. That insect can thrive when the conditions are dry, so their numbers have been built up. There were a lot of eggs that overwintered. We knew there were going to be a lot of caterpillars this year, and that came to be true. However, one thing that has started happening recently in about the last 2 weeks or so is, in some areas, many of the caterpillars are dying off, and there's actually a couple of different reasons for that.
What's going on?
Well, it turns out the rainy weather has really been helping us out. I mentioned a moment ago that when you have a dry year, their populations can do really well and increase. If you have rainy weather, it can encourage some diseases that are very specific to spongy moth. There happens to be a fungus that was introduced specifically to control this insect, and it's very specific to spongy moth in terms of what it does. And being a fungus, it's intuitive when you think about this, but damp conditions will favor it. And with that said, we have had, in many areas of Wisconsin, very regular rain. And if you have these damp, rainy, humid conditions, the fungus can get going, and it can actually go through a generation in about a week or so, release more spores to infect more caterpillars. And so if the rains continue, it really helps it out. And then there's also a virus that has been kicking in. And this can happen when you have higher populations. I mean, we know this intuitively, living through the COVID situation, when COVID first started, we had social distancing. If you pack people together, you get more disease spread, or potentially same kind of thing can happen with insects such as spongy moth caterpillars. And so there's this fungus that's killing them in some areas. There's also the virus. And sometimes you can find dead caterpillars on the same tree. And if you know what to look for, you can kind of tell what killed them. The ones killed by a fungus, they tend to hang straight down. And the ones killed by a virus, they tend to remain attached by the middle of their body, and they hang down in an inverted V shape. And so I saw lots of this last week out in parts of Iowa County. I've had reports from southeastern Wisconsin as well. So I think the weather is really helping us out, and that might help curb the spongy moth outbreak we've been seeing.
So virus, upside down V, that's a way to remember, it. So, and last year was it 373,000 acres in the state were affected?
Yeah, of forested areas. That came out of a DNR report. And that was a record in terms of defoliation by this insect. So being a non-native invasive species, they can pose a lot of risks to trees in forested areas, but also in urban areas. And it's something that has been on my radar, because if you have, say, oak trees that are defoliated again and again, they start running ragged, and then you get secondary issues that pop up. And over the course of a few years, if that continues, it's not a good trajectory for the plants.
And the fungal disease of the spongy moth does not a threat to the trees. It's that
Correct. Yeah, it's very, very specific. And this is generally true of most what we call entomopathogens. These are diseases that specifically infect insects. And in many cases, they're very, very specific in what they do. So it's that disease is harmless to the trees. It's harmless to people and pets and stuff like that. It's just this thing that's out there in nature now, and it infects and kills spongy moth caterpillars.
In terms of control, then, maybe the control measures won't need to be as, there won't need to be as much spraying, aerial spraying?
Potentially. And with the aerial spraying in the state, that's really a long-term planning process. So groups like the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, they have to survey traps for number of adult males caught. They can do egg mass surveys, and that's going to inform decisions for next year. And if populations crash this year, we very well may see less aerial spraying next year. There's not nearly as much done these days compared to historically, but still, that might help us out in the long run if these rainy conditions continue and their populations continue to crash.
Hard to imagine how we would be able to reduce the spread of spongy moths.
Well,
or are there ways?
There are some ways when you think about it. And we do technically in the state have a quarantine for spongy moth that relates to things like, say, nursery stock or Christmas trees, because for the most part, spongy moth can be pretty common in the eastern, maybe two-thirds of the state, but the western edge of the state, not so much. And so because of the quarantine, you can't take stuff from an area where spongy moth is hot and heavy and move it to western areas or take it to Minnesota or something like that. So really making sure that you're not moving these insects around. That could mean having nursery stock inspected and things like that. So it's kind of regulatory things, but also just you and I, we've probably seen billboards for this to not move firewood.
Yeah.
That's a potential route of spread. Probably the biggest concern with spongy moth in my mind is during the colder months of the year, or even later this summer and fall when the eggs are present, because if you have one egg mass, that can be 500 to maybe 1,000 eggs. And so if you move, say, five egg masses, that could be upwards of 5,000 caterpillars when those hatch. So really checking, you know, if you were moving a trailer or a camper, check the undersides of that and that sort of thing to make sure those aren't present, or if they are, scrape them off. That's one step that humans can take to help reduce the spread.
Moving on to other areas, I'm pretty sure you spent some time in the Lake Geneva area this a few weeks back for the cicadas.
Yes, yes. I had a chance to head down there and check it out, and it was amazing to see, a very surreal experience. And we actually held a couple weeks ago on June 8th an event called Cicada Palooza. And this was an event to celebrate the emergence of these insects, because in Wisconsin, we only see them every 17 years.
Yeah.
Even popped into Jill Nadeau, stopped by the event there. So it was great. It did rain that day, which put a little bit of a damper on things, but we still had about 500 folks sign up to take guided walking tours. We had about 15 or so tented booths with all sorts of insect activities for the family. And we had some indoor talks, which ended up being standing room only. So it went off really, really well. It was a fun event.
And we certainly got our cicadas.
We did, and they're still out there. If you want to see the periodical cicadas and you haven't seen them yet, you still have a little bit of time, but I wouldn't delay at all. I would get out there as soon as you can, because over the next two or so weeks, they're going to be disappearing, and we won't see them again for 17 more years.
Oh, my goodness. So it was a lot of fun. I know it was a lot of work for you. You were telling me you did a lot of media interviews.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride the last two or so months. Essentially, once April came, the floodgates kind of opened when all the cicadas started emerging in other parts of the country. And it's definitely caught everyone's attention, but I liken it to the solar eclipse we had earlier this year. How many times can you witness that? And once every 17 years in Wisconsin, that's a pretty cool and pretty special natural phenomenon to see.
We'll give you a chance to join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Mark in Green Bay will give you an opportunity. Thanks for calling, Mark.
Hi, thanks a lot for the opportunity. I live on the west shore of the southern end of Green Bay and been out here for many years. Ordinarily, around Memorial Day, there's a big hatch of bayflies, and there's usually two or three different cohorts that come through on that. This year, there was virtually none. I was wondering if you heard anything that's going on in the southern end of the bay that would have reduced their numbers, or was it lack of ice cover and because of changed conditions from that? Just wondering if you have any information.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, and that's the first that I had heard about this, but it does bring a couple of things to mind. Perhaps the mild winter and lack of ice cover. That might have affected some things. It can also depend on the mayfly species and their individual life cycles and the lengths of that. But I do wonder if it may be kind of on the side of weather and environmental related. Just with the unusual winter weather we had, perhaps that has shifted things out and it might be changing their emergence pattern a little bit.
Thank you very much for calling. Jim and Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I was in Chicago last week. My daughter lives there, and she was crazed all spring because she thought it was going to be just loud. And I barely heard a cicada in the week that I was there in northwest Chicago. So I was really surprised about that.
Yeah, well, one thing that really stands out to me about the periodical cicadas is they can be really, really localized. You can have them in a given spot, like some of the suburbs of Chicago area or in Wisconsin, a spot like Lake Geneva, and you can drive 10, 15 minutes down the road and you'll have none at all. It can be really hit or miss. So if you're in the right spot, I know the Chicago area in general had a lot of them, and I have colleagues that went down there, very loud, lots of them, very abundant. But again, if you were just outside one of those cicada spots, you would have maybe only heard a few or perhaps none at all.
Very, very interesting. Phil in Marshfield emailed to ask if chinch bugs will be less of a problem than last summer. Also because of the recent wet weather.
I suspect so. And that's typically the pattern that I would see with these chinch bugs. And we talked about spongy moth earlier. That can thrive with dry conditions. There's some things like spider mites that thrive with dry conditions. But we know chinch bugs do very well when it's dry. Just like the spongy moths, if it's rainy, then they can become sick with some insect diseases, and that can help keep their numbers down. So I did see some activity of chinch bug last year. This year at the diagnostic lab, it's been very, very quiet. So that rain is probably helping us out.
Gary in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Sure. I have a question about insect populations. I mean, I heard it recently said that populations are down, and one evidence for that is that when you take a trip, you no longer have to clean off your windshield with the splattered bugs. But I make quite a few trips from Milwaukee to central Wisconsin, and my experience lately is that, well, put it this way, my windshield is a mess, and the grill on my truck is a mess. And I'm just wondering if, with splattered bugs, and I'm just wondering if that's evidence that populations are back up and maybe we're doing something right, although I do wish the bugs could avoid running into my truck.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. What about it, PJ?
Yeah, there is something called essentially the windshield phenomenon, which is, as the caller described, historically, you know, we'd maybe drive up to the North Woods and you have to stop every hour or so to squeegee your windshield off, and folks just aren't having to do that as much anymore. Based on this recent scientific literature that I've been seeing, it does seem like these declines are happening and certainly are a concern. However, there can be a lot of variability. And when you think about insects, over a million described worldwide, probably in the ballpark of 20,000 in Wisconsin. It depends on the day and the time you're out. If you are happening to be driving at a moment when there was just an emergence of insect species A or B, it's going to seem like they're very abundant and lots on your windshield. And so it's really hard to pick out the trends from windshield viewing alone. Ideally, what you would want is to have very long-term data sets with lots and lots of data in it. There have been some studies that looked at things like this. There was one that came out several years ago in Germany where they had trap data from, I think it was about 30 or so years, and so they could really start to pick out some of these long-term trends. But there can be a lot of variability from day to day.
Thanks, Gary, for calling. Appreciate it. PJ Leash, our guest today, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking the world of insects today with PJ Leash, who is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him come by. And questions? Give us a call. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or if you want to email us, maybe you've got an insect photo. I think we can probably do an ID on that. Or just a question that you want to email in, go to talk@WPR.org for that. Let's go to Dot in Manitowoc. Hi, Dot.
Good morning. I would like to share my observation about insects, and particularly the fruit fly. Of course, I have fruit flies in my kitchen with bananas and well, all sorts of fruits. And I put an apple in my TV room, and it didn't take long for the fruit flies, they're not bigger than a pinhead, that they can detect and smell that fruit and travel, let's say, 15 feet, let's say 20 feet, into another room. To me, that's a miracle.
Dot, thank you. PJ, what about that? Can they smell that good?
Yeah, I think so. And it turns out a lot of insects have really a pretty darn good sense of smell. It's a little different than ours, though. When you look at insects, and we've all probably seen this, maybe you've seen a moth with really big, bushy, feathery antennae. There's chemical receptors on the antennae, and so that can be a key way that insects can smell. So if you look at, like, male moths at night, they use these big feathery antennae to smell the pheromone plume from a female, which could be a long distance away. Mm. So in general, insects have evolved to be able to, you know, detect the smells and odors and chemicals that are key to their life cycle. And for fruit flies, that is going to be sugary substances that are maybe starting to ferment a bit. So that could be fruit that's a little on the overripe side. Mm-hmm. Or they will also commonly go to things like beer and wine and alcohol for that yeasty, fermenty type smell too.
Kay emailed to ask if the rain will tamp down the usual Japanese beetle infestations.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish I had a magical crystal ball that could tell us exactly how Japanese beetle season is going to go this year. I would say it depends a little bit on where you are in the state. In general, the last 2 to 3 years, my observations have been that in much of southern Wisconsin, populations have generally been down compared to what they were, say, a decade or 15 or so years ago. Now, there were still hot spots, and you could be in an area that was generally down, but maybe your yard had, kind of more typical numbers. But southern Wisconsin as a whole tended to be down the last couple years. I suspect that will still be the case this year, and a reason for that is what we are going to be seeing emerging here any day now, the adult Japanese beetles, those were from eggs laid last summer when it was dry and kind of hard on them. If we continue to have rainy conditions and lush green lawns, that might offer more places for the females to lay eggs. And what that could mean is a lot of eggs laid this year, and that might mean potentially an increase next year. Don't know for sure at this point, but I suspect we might have a bit of reprieve this year and possibly increase 2025. But if you are in a part of the state that had heavy populations last year, one area that comes to mind would be the region between about Sheboygan, Oshkosh, Green Bay, Door County Peninsula, kind of that triangular area. That is a part of the state that accounted for most of my reports of significant damage from both adults and the larvae or grubs and turf grass areas. And then another interesting thing to note is more southern Wisconsin, basically about Highway 29 corridor and north, historically, say 10, 15 years ago, very, very few records from that part of state. Now we're seeing Japanese beetles show up more and more and keep pushing farther north in the state. And the mild winter probably is going to help them out in that regard.
Hmm. Tom in Oconto has a question for you, so let's go there. Tom, hello.
Hi, I've just spent the last couple months up in the northern forest, up on the Nicolet National Forest, and there are several places where forest tent caterpillars are taking off. And if I remember correctly, the last time I've seen something like this was back in the late 80s, and I think it's 2-3 years? This is the first year. Next year should be the bad one.
Good question, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that is a really good question, Tom. And I'm going to be really curious to see how this turns out. So with forest tent caterpillars, we do know from historical records that we would tend to see an outbreak maybe every decade or so. The last big outbreak we'd had was right around the turn of the millennium. It was like late 90s, early 2000s, if I remember correctly. So with that said, we're a little bit overdue. It's been almost 25 years. I know DNR colleagues have seen some activity. They noted that in their annual report from last year. Recently, I've had some reports from north central Wisconsin, places like Lincoln County. So I know it's out there. Is this the buildup of a bigger outbreak? It's possible. Only time will tell for sure. But it has been really interesting to watch these increases in some part of the state. And I think it's something that we should perhaps be prepared for. That way, if we do have an outbreak in the next year or two, it's something that we'll have on our mind.
Merritt in Wausau emailed wondering what's the best method to get rid of ant colonies in their yard. Merritt says they have at least 10 of them in the yard.
To be honest, it depends a bit on the type of ant.
Yeah.
You know, if you have very tiny anthills in like a turf grass area, those can be relatively easy to deal with. You can also have these larger mounds from field ants, and sometimes these mounds might be a foot across. I've seen them 3-4 feet across and mounded up sometimes a foot or more. Those are much more difficult to eliminate. And also anytime it comes to a question about eliminating ants in a yard, I'd like to kind of ask folks, you know, what's your reasoning behind this? If you have, say, a big yard and they're just out in a prairie area or the woods, my philosophy is there's probably not really any need to eliminate those because ants can provide a lot of benefits to the ecosystem in terms of being a predator and attacking pest insects and things like that. If they're in a spot where it's interfering with human activities, yeah, you can certainly draw the line in the sand. If they do happen to be large ant nests or large mounds, that would be our field ants. And those, the catch is the bulk of the colony can often be a couple feet below ground. And so if you just apply an ant control product to the surface, it may quiet things down temporarily, but they're almost certainly going to come back over time. In a case like that, what you would ideally want to do is use a liquid type ant control product that you can mix up in like a bucket with a volume of water, go to the ant nest and poke a dowel rod or rebar, something down into the mound to make some channels, and then slowly drench the liquid in there to allow it to soak deeper into the nest. That tends to work much better than just treating the soil or mound surface.
Bradley in Whitewater will give you a chance. Hi, Bradley.
The Williams Bay area, which is close to Lake Geneva, and I got to experience the cicadas down there. There were two things that I noticed. First, the sound. It was higher pitched and more constant than what I'm used to. But then also, as I was driving around and I got to see some flying and even on driveways, you know, in front of me, I noted how much smaller this year's or this emergence of cicada is from any other cicada that I've ever seen. And so I was wondering if you could talk about the size difference and how much variability there is, not just in their size, but then also in their sounds.
Sure. Yeah, when you think about cicadas, so we've got over a dozen different species in the Midwest. Worldwide, there's over 3,000 different species. And anytime you're talking about diversity like that, there's going to be a range of different sizes, colorations, and general appearances. there are in North America some very small cicadas called grass cicadas, and the adults of those have a length of maybe 3/4 of an inch. They're really quite small. If you go to tropical areas, there are some species that can have wingspans pushing maybe 6 to 7 inches and can be very, very large and hefty. Now, in the state, when we usually think of cicadas, we're probably thinking of our annual, like, dog day cicadas we see during the dog days of summer in July, August, September. So those will come out in about a month or so. And those do tend to be a little bit larger in physical size compared to the periodical cicadas that are out at the moment. The coloration is also different as well. And then the songs are very different. Pretty much any insect species that produces sound or sings for mating purposes, the sound is going to be a little bit different from species to species. Otherwise, they could get confused if they all sounded too close to one another. So they do certainly have a very different, unique sound. I will say for the periodical cicadas, it's actually, I think, kind of a pleasant sound to listen to. You have all these males singing. You get this chorusing effect. Although if you're close enough to an individual male, you can pick out the song of that individual male, which is pretty neat to listen to.
Bradley, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us a photo or a question to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I wanted to talk a little bit about Joro spiders. They are the coolest looking spiders, but there have been news reports, and they're big. They're big, and I guess they're venomous. But they're extending their range on the East Coast. Could they ever make it to the upper Midwest? They're the coolest, scariest, brightest things I remember seeing.
They are really cool looking spiders. With Joro spiders, they certainly have been in the news. They are large, although some of the news articles, I think, maybe overstated their size a little bit. The adult female Joro spider, her body is maybe a little over an inch long.
Yeah.
And with the legs, that might be, you know, in the ballpark of 3-ish inches or so. We do actually have some spiders in the state that are close to that size. We have one that's fairly common called a black and yellow garden spider.
Yeah.
And those
pretty spiders.
They are, yeah. Classic orb weaver. They make their big web. They sit in it. Very conspicuous coloring. And so these Joro spiders are maybe just a hint bigger than that. Technically venomous, although for the most part, pretty much all spiders have venom to subdue their prey. So really not any sort of medical concern. But scientists are watching these because they're not native to North America. They came from parts of East Asia. They've maybe been in the country since, maybe even close to a decade or so at this point. We don't know exactly when they showed up. But it's something that folks are keeping a close eye on. We think they might have come over with international trade, shipping containers, hitchhiking, something along those lines. What's really interesting to me, I have a colleague who did his PhD here at UW-Madison, Dr. Dave Coyle. He's now down in Georgia for his position, and so he's been someone that's been dealing with a lot of Joro spider interviews. And he published a paper recently that looked at some climate modeling for Joro spiders. So they looked at climate variables and the native range of the spider, things like winter temperature, summer temperature, precipitation, and saw how did that line up with North America. And what was really interesting to me is where they have been found thus far, which is northern part of Georgia, the Carolinas, and a little bit of Tennessee, that is actually predicted by the model not to be the greatest of habitat for them. The area to the north of that is actually expected to be probably more suitable, which we didn't think initially. And so we suspect they may be pushing farther north. And then that paper, it actually mentioned that the Great Lakes region might actually be some decent habitat for them. So will they get here? we don't know for sure, but based on the modeling paper, if they do, they may have some decent habitat here and weather conditions for them.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And they're not aggressive. My understanding is you could put your hand near them and they're not going to run over and bite you.
Right, right. They're actually surprisingly docile. They're perhaps just a little bit intimidating because of their size. And if you're in a spot where these spiders are very abundant, they can make lots of webs up high, like on power lines and stuff like that. So it's very conspicuous. They're generalist predators. So harmless to humans. If in theory you were bitten by one, it would probably be like a localized bee or wasp sting. Your finger's not going to fall off or anything like that. It probably wouldn't feel pleasant. But again, it's just their behavior is they don't want to bite you. You'd probably have to pester them until they did that. One interesting thing from the paper, though, they also looked at potential impacts on native spiders here. And there may be some impacts there. In areas where these Juro spiders are common, the native orb weaver spiders seem to be less abundant. So are these displacing some of the native species? That's possible. And that could be a impact of these invasive spiders.
Mm. Bert in Rice Lake, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question involves a couple of anthills right up in my front yard, one at the base of an oak tree and one at the base of an apple tree. I'm wondering why they chose to be there. They're kind of a black ant, medium size, and if they're using the tree for food or harming the tree in some way, I was just curious about the placement of them.
Sure.
Yeah, and Bert, are you seeing a mound in the ground at the base of those trees, or you're just seeing the ants on the trees themselves?
No, they're bringing the soil up into a small mound. So, you can see the mound at the base, and when I wee-whack around it, it kind of takes the top of that off, but they just rebuild it.
Okay. Well, my thought in a case like this is it might be helpful to grab a couple of those ants and send them into my lab, which is the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you just do an online search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you should be able to find it pretty easily. And the reason I say that, when I think of kind of midsize or larger-ish ants, there are black ones that can be field ants. There's black ones that can be carpenter ants. If it's something like field ants that is nesting in the ground, sometimes they will just pick a spot because of the kind of microclimate, the small-scale environmental conditions. And if the tree is providing shade and helping regulate the temperature of the colony, that might be a reason why they pick that given spot. But if they ended up being something more along the lines of carpenter ants and they have a nest there, that might suggest the presence of decaying wood. And so in a case like this, identifying the ants could help us learn a little bit more about what may be going on in that situation.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Bert, collect a few. Send them in to the Insect Diagnostic Lab. That would be great. I wanted to bring up Pollinator Week. I saw an interesting article before we get into that from Lisa Gomnitz from the DNR, and she was had the question, how's your bird feeder been doing lately? And the reason a lot of bird feeders aren't doing so well is because this is the feeding time for nesting birds, and they're after caterpillars.
Yes. Yeah, it turns out that most songbirds, or for the most part, almost all of them, as far as I know, rely on insects for food to be able to raise their young. And often in spring, that means caterpillars, which can be very abundant. We have thousands of different caterpillars in the state on a wide range of woody trees, shrubs, and even annual and perennial plants. And so those birds rely very heavily on those insects. And that also brings up the idea of, concerns for birds. If we have insect declines, what sort of impact is that going to have for birds in the long run? So I think it's really important to bring up Pollinator Week and talk about it because, celebrating pollinators and helping them out can also maybe have some cascading effects on other animals like birds.
Yeah, she had a photo of some black-capped chickadees, and they're out after caterpillars from 6 in the morning till 8 at night. for the 16 to 18 days it takes those chicks to fledge. And she cited Doug Tallamy's research. He said that's 350 to 570 caterpillars every day, depending on how many chicks they have. So an incredible 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars are required to make one clutch of chickadees. And they're tiny birds, just, you know, a third of an ounce.
Yeah, it's always mind-boggling to me, Larry. Those birds are so industrious, having to go on, you know, essentially a scavenger hunt to find these caterpillars, which can often be well camouflaged, blending in on leaves and twigs and things like that, and find hundreds and hundreds of them again and again to be able to feed their young and pull it off. That's impressive.
PJ Leash, our guest, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at the world of insects today on the show with PJ Leash, who is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him? We got open lines, get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And if you want to include an insect photo, please go right ahead and do that in your email, and we'll take a look at it and see what we can come up with here for you. Back to Pollinator Week. It's, you know, an opportunity to encourage people to help the bees and the butterflies and all the moths that transfer pollen.
Yeah, and one thing that always stands out to me is when you mention the word pollinator, often folks think of honeybees, and for very good reason. Honeybees are really important agriculturally to be able to produce crops like apples and blueberries and cranberries and things like that. But honeybees are technically not native to Wisconsin or North America. They were introduced with Europeans. And they're only one species of bee. We have in Wisconsin somewhere in the range of 400 to 500 or so species. So there's honeybee, there's about maybe two dozen or so species of bumblebees. The rest, for the most part, are these solitary wild bees. Each female nests alone, either in hollow stems of plants that they've kind of chewed out the pithy center and tunneled in there, or about maybe 60-ish, 70-ish% are ground nesting species. They have a little nest that looks just like an anthill in the ground, and essentially one bee lives in there, and she's got to do all the work of gathering supplies, laying eggs, kind of provisioning everything her young will need to develop. But pollination doesn't stop at bees. There's lots of flies that do it, and we're actually learning more and more about flies all the time and their importance. You go to some places on the planet, and flies are the key pollinators, especially high altitudes up in the Arctic. It's too cold for the bees, but flies have a way to kind of warm themselves up. We're also learning more and more about moths and butterflies too, although, you know, we've got over 100 species of butterflies in Wisconsin. We've got thousands of species of moths, and for a long time, folks kind of thought of moths as drab and just kind of blah, yeah. And we are learning more and more about how important they can be. And what's really interesting to me is sometimes it's species that we would consider the caterpillar stage to be a pest, like armyworm caterpillars, but the adults can be really important pollinators. So it's trying to untangle all these nuances, but moths can be pollinators, beetles can be pollinators, other insects can be pollinators. Sometimes vertebrates like hummingbirds can be pollinators too. And when we hear about insect declines, which we talked about a little bit earlier, I think it's really important to celebrate these insects, really look at what they do, and not to take their ecosystem services for granted. They are doing things that benefit humans and other organisms by pollinating those plants. You know, if you think about our food supply, that's really important. But pollinating wild plants is a service as well. And so it's important to celebrate these insects, embrace what they do, but also try and do things to protect them in our yards and the landscape around us.
You know, my beds, flower beds that are between the street and the sidewalk, this year, and I normally don't clean up those beds very much until pretty late, because I want to protect those insect eggs and so forth. This year, I did nothing. I just let it go. And you know what? The plants came up. Everything disappeared, and I think I might have maybe picked out two or three little stalks of something late.
Yeah, and there can be a lot of value to either not doing a cleanup or delaying it as long as possible.
Because
there's plenty of insects that can use that fallen old plant material as overwintering, shelter and habitat. And if you clean that up early and it's bare ground and the insects that were there have either been removed with the material or they've been exposed to cold frosts and things like that, that's going to be a lot harder on them.
Jay in Madison has a question for you. Jay, hi.
Hi there. We recently had a big old green ash tree that they pulled down because the emerald ash borers had been decimating trees and it's hit our street. And I know you were talking a little bit about birds fledging their young. And I recently read a very interesting book about oaks and how important they are as a native species. Wondering about replacing those emerald ash or those ash trees with something that's more conducive to helping birds and the wildlife. And then what kind of insects might they, might more native trees attract? And sort of wondering about it, whether there's an opportunity there for consulting with the city to have trees, more diverse trees that attract insects.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating topic. I mean, it's, I'm sorry to hear about losing that tree to emerald ash borer. It's something a lot of folks have gone through, but it's an interesting topic when you think about replacing those trees, and especially from the standpoint of can we do things to kind of increase or the benefits we can provide to insects. Diversity is going to be part of that, but I'm guessing you maybe bumped into that book by Doug Tallamy on oaks, and it turns out oaks are really impressive for the breadth of insect life that they can support. Doug was also on a paper that came out fairly recently, and they surveyed and looked at some of the literature on trees and which ones support the greatest numbers of insects. And it really boiled down to a list of about 10 or so key tree species or types. Oaks was at the very top, but it was about 10 types of trees that supported the bulk of insects from the particular group they were looking at. And so I think that's one thing to consider is maybe look within this list of 10 or so trees to help maximize. But also you brought up another important point, which is diversification of your urban forest. Because we've learned with emerald ash borer, we had a lot of ash trees planted in some cities because after Dutch elm went through and took out the elm trees, they said ash trees are hardy, great for urban areas, planted a bunch of them, and then along came EAB, took them all out or took out an awful lot of them. And so over time, I think urban foresters have caught on more and more and really understand that diversity is key. So picking and choosing trees for diversity, but also meshing that with the idea of providing support for insects, I think that can be a really important approach to take.
I would agree with that. Thank you, Jay. Appreciate it. Gary in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I'm driving back from Merrill, Wisconsin to Northern Illinois, and WPR has been a longtime companion on these trips. My question is, I have little black ants that appear every summer in our kitchen. I don't know where the nest is, but I see them, and we call them sugar ants, and I don't know if that's the right term or not. But I'm looking for suggestions on how to deal with this ant infestation.
Sure. Well, small black ants in a kitchen, the top suspect that comes to mind is a species called the odorous house ant. And this is a species that loves sugary materials. One really interesting way that you could confirm this fairly easily, other than getting them under the microscope, but for this species, the odorous house ant, if you were to catch one of the live ants and squish it, and this might sound a little funny, but take a smell and see what it smells like. That odorous house ant has a smell that's been described as either blue cheese or kind of fermenting coconut. To me, it smells more like the coconut, maybe a hint of fermentation in there. But these ants have a distinct smell. And so that's a really quick and dirty way to confirm the species. If it is, the sugar-based baits tend to work very well. So that could mean going to the hardware store and getting like a taro liquid ant bait, which is essentially borax in a sugary gel or liquid. That is going to tend to work very well. Odorous house ants, though, are really interesting. with their colonies. They often, out in a yard, will have not just one colony, but a network that could be dozens of colonies out there. They're also very good at just picking up and moving very, very quickly. I've got in my yard one of those fake rock Haida keys to stash a spare key.
Sure.
Almost every summer, I go to check that, and these have moved in. And you open it up, and you set it down to, you know, grab soapy water, something like that. And you come back 5-10 minutes later, they're gone.
They're gone.
So they can move very, very quickly. So with that said, it's really common to have these, like, show up in your kitchen, and if you use the sugar-based baits, you can get them to leave and often disappear within a few days. And then there might be more out in your yard, but if they are out there just doing their own thing and not coming in, my philosophy is, could you just leave them? That's certainly a consideration. And if they come back in, maybe take out the sugary bait again to quiet them down.
There you go, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Sussex, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you, and great show as usual.
Thank you.
If you want a really, really good pollinator, feeder, whatever you call them, a mountain ash tree that I have, a couple of them, are just swarming with pollinators when they bloom. I mean swarming, and a lot of them are flies and stuff. I don't even know what it is. But later in the year, when those little mountain ash berries are ripe, the birds go after them. So you got a dual purpose plant there, or tree.
Mountain ash. Mark, thanks. A comment on that, PJ.
Yeah, I happen to like mountain ash. From my perspective as an entomologist, I really don't see too many issues with them for insect pests. I know they're not super common in the landscape compared to some of our, you know, oaks and stuff like that, but I've always been a fan of those plants. They do offer those very colorful, attractive berries, so there can be some resources there too. And as the caller mentioned, you know, when those are in bloom, that can draw a pretty wide range of pollinators. So I think that's something that certainly can be considered for your own yard.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Wondered about the Karner blue butterfly. It's federally endangered. So's the rusty-patched bumblebee. I remember a long time ago, one of my graduate students who was in communications but was involved in the research project relating to the Karner blue butterfly and was endangered then. It's still endangered now, but it's still around. But how are they doing?
Yeah, so last time I looked into them, both of those seem to be doing all right in the state, which is some good news. The bumblebee, rusty patch bumblebee, that's a relatively new addition to the endangered species list. But it is good to see at this point that their populations seem to be doing okay in the state, because other parts of the country, it hasn't necessarily been the same story. But again, both of those seem to be doing okay was the latest that I heard.
That is excellent news. What about monarchs?
Yeah, with monarchs, one of the key ways that we can assess monarch populations is to look at the overwintering numbers down in Mexico. Because if you think about that migration, we have monarchs coming from all over the eastern U.S. They get funneled down to a small mountainous area outside of Mexico City, and then they congregate together very densely on trees. And so what scientists can do is, rather than trying to count individual butterflies, they look at the density and they actually measure the area that they occupy. And so that is kind of our meter stick, so to speak. They can estimate that area every year. We have seen over time, over, say, the last 30 years, that's been going down. So it has been a tough situation for the monarch butterflies. One thing that's perhaps a little bit encouraging this year is I have seen some really pretty early in the year. I've saw some up in northern Wisconsin, even in late May around Memorial Day weekend, and that was early for that part of the state. Often, once they leave their overwintering ground, it takes them a couple generations to get up to Wisconsin. So getting up here early, will that give them time to maybe squeeze in an extra generation and increase their numbers? That's a possibility. We'll have to stay tuned, though, to see their numbers next winter.
Speaking of staying tuned, PJ Leash, our guest today, who is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Stay with us. We're taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Really appreciate it. Just wanted to mention that our June member drive is coming up on the 27th, so it's just coming up really quick now. You can help fund the programs and coverage that you rely on. You can do it right now, actually. And we've got a little deal going here. When 500 donors give before the drive starts, a group of generous members will add in an extra $10,000. So I'm calling them the first 500. You can become one of those first 500 donors with a gift, any amount, by the way, at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate, and we'd love to hear from you. Also, if you have a question for PJ, this would be a good time to call because we've got open lines at 800-642-1234. So give a call. You can also email us to talk@WPR.org. PJ, we have a couple of photos. Jeff in La Crosse emailed a photo of a bug he found tucked in and partially hidden in the shade above the kitchen sink a couple of weeks ago. It's about an inch long, all black, it looks like, and they've never seen anything like it before.
So this is actually a fairly common one called the mast hunter bug, and it's from the assassin bug group, the family Regiviidae. It's a type that can occur indoors. They can also be spotted outdoors at times, but they can be indoors and will serve as a predator of other insects that are around. What really is cool to me, though, is, I mean, the adults are big, one of the larger insects you might bump into indoors, but if you can find one of the juveniles are going to be much smaller, and they'll actually camouflage themselves with bits of lint and dust and debris. And so if you've never seen them before, you would just say, is that a walking dust bunny? And you'd have to look it up close, and then you'd see the legs and antennae sticking out of it.
And Dan in Madison emails to say they have several Dutchman's pipe vines in their yard. And this morning, Dan saw eggs and baby caterpillars on the plants. They sent us a photo. Are these pipe vine swallowtails?
Yes, I took a peek at that photo, and it does appear to be a pipe vine swallowtail. Those caterpillars tend to be dark-colored, and they almost have these long kind of tentacle-like structures that stick out of them. And that's an interesting species because we usually don't see them much in Wisconsin. They do better in warmer areas, and we don't really have a whole lot of Dutchman's pipe unless you specifically plant it. I know folks that have had that plant for years after year after year, and they never see these. And then every once in a while, they can find it. Now, this ties in with something we talked about earlier, Larry, with the fruit flies and sense of smell.
Yeah.
Imagine a pipevine swallowtail adult female, you know, being able to detect this one plant out of all the plants around us, being able to cue in using some chemical clues, find it and lay eggs is pretty impressive when you think about it.
It is indeed. Well, Rick in Monona has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hi. My story is I was walking my dog recently a couple of times, and as I got on my route, I looked down and I saw this like army of little red ants, thousands of them, all running in different directions, and this at the curb. And I right away I wondered, well, what causes ants to abandon their nest like that? And then what happens to them once they're out like that, all running around? Do they find another nest? Or are they is it over occupancy that drives them all out of their nest? I'll just wait for your answer.
All right, thanks, Rick.
Yeah, interesting observation, Rick, and thanks for sharing that. A couple of things could be going on. One thing is that it can be really common this time of the year to go out for a walk in Madison or nearby areas and other parts of the state too, for that matter, and see colonies of pavement ants, which are these small kind of reddish brown ants, but colonies of these pavement ants essentially duking it out, fighting for territory. And so if you ever look down and there's just a spot like the size of a softball, a gazillion ants there, that is probably what it is. Now, in a case like this, if it didn't seem like they were all hanging out in the same spot, and if you look close, they'd be duking it out. But if they seem to be deliberately exiting an area, a couple of things could be going on. One is if the nesting site itself was damaged or attacked, or if it were to have something to do to make it kind of less than ideal. Maybe it was soaked and waterlogged. Some species of ants are really adept at just picking up the colony and moving somewhere else. I mentioned this earlier with odorous house ants. So that could be a possibility. If you had a nest that's got a bunch of rain and they're just too soaking and wet in there, they might look for higher and drier locations. If you had a colony of other ants come in and attack them, that could be a possible explanation as well.
Rick, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Marty in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Marty.
Hi. I'm wondering if you guys can help identify hundreds of tiny little, like the size of three pinheads, red and black bugs. They're sort of some kind of a beetle. I'm almost wondering... So earlier this year, we had a lot of box elder bugs around outside the house. Could they be
babies?
Like really young ones or babies of them? Yeah.
Yeah, and if you saw a lot of box elder bugs earlier over the winter months, that very well could be what those are. The juvenile box elder bugs, because they go through incomplete metamorphosis, they're going to have the same kind of general shape as the adults, just much, much smaller. And the juveniles will actually go through a bunch of sub stages, get progressively larger, but they're all going to be essentially reddish with a little bit of black on it. So I suspect that is probably what you're seeing is just a bunch of juvenile ones at the moment.
Oh, very interesting. Marty, thank you so much. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Diane in Darlington next. Hi, Diane.
Hi. So I'm calling about fireflies or lightning bugs. I don't seem to see them as much as I have, and I'd like to know if there's anything I could do on my property to help their numbers. I saw them one time in a field. There was hundreds of thousands of them. It was like the most magical thing I ever saw, and I would like to see that again. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, the firefly situation is going to be interesting this year. In general, firefly juveniles, that is the larvae, they really need some damp habitat. They love damp areas, lots of moisture, lots of plants and vegetation. And so if you wanted to pick out some good habitat for them, in my mind, it would probably be valleys, like drive through the driftless area and locations like that, versus if you are in an area that is flatter, more open, and maybe you don't have as much vegetation. You know, if this was a yard that had just a lawn and that was all you had for your yard, that's not going to be great firefly habitat. They can feed on slugs as juveniles, and so good slug habitat is going to be good for these. But also, one thing I'm going to be curious to see this year is how they are faring compared to kind of historical numbers, because the weather we had last year was very dry, and in some areas it's been dry for a couple of years in a row.
Yeah.
And so if you had those conditions that might have been harder on them, perhaps less suitable habitat, But a year like this year with all the rain, that's probably going to be good for them in the long run. So it's possible you see some year-to-year fluctuation based on weather patterns. But again, if you really wanted to see them in your yard, you could do things like just increase vegetation, more vegetation, hold in more moisture. That could be good for them. But also, if you want to go see some hot spots, probably taking a little road trip into some areas with valleys, again, more plants, more moisture. Those are usually going to be good spots to see them.
All right. There you go, Diane. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Some emails here. Jeff emailed. They have 20 pepper plants, jalapeno and greenbell, that have aphids on the undersides of the leaves, and currently they're lightly blasting them off with water, treating with a very mild water dish soap solution twice a day, early mornings and evenings. Jeff wants to know if aphids normally last the entire growing season. His raised garden bed is on the Menominee River near Porterfield and north of Marinette.
Okay. Yeah, with aphids, they can be influenced quite a bit by environmental conditions, weather. If it's really rainy, they can actually come down sick with some beneficial diseases that can kill them off. One pattern that I often see with them is they'll get a start earlier in the season. And if you compare it to running a marathon, the aphids just take off sprinting and their populations shoot up. But in the long run, often beneficial predators and parasites will catch up and eventually help suppress their numbers. But aphids can be really pretty common throughout the entire growing season on garden veggies. A couple of thoughts on management. You can certainly blast them off with a strong jet or stream of water from a garden hose, but I would maybe caution against that if we have really rainy conditions, because we don't want to keep plants too wet and encourage fungal disease. So that's just something to keep in mind. The soap solution can work, and sounds like what you're doing with water and a little bit of dish soap, if that seems to be helping you, great. Otherwise, sometimes with dish soap, the colors and fragrances and moisturizers might not be the greatest for the plants, and so you could try more of a pure insecticidal soap from the hardware store. That can work. You have to keep in mind it only works by contact. So you have to spray it directly on the aphids, meaning get good spray coverage, the undersides of leaves. Some other options could be a horticultural oil like neem oil or something like pyrethrins. Those would all be organic options. There's conventional products too, but if you're trying to do things organic, those would be some good options for you to try. Just keep in mind, you're going to have to kind of go through this rinse and repeat process. You have to scout, treat as needed, keep scouting again and again, and treat as needed.
Dennis in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. PJ, I don't know if I misunderstood it, but apparently there was some, the diagnostic lab was involved in some kind of a sting operation with a scorpion that was in a guy's basement.
Well, no sting involved. this was an interesting situation, though, where a gentleman had been watching TV in his basement. He saw something move out of the corner of his eye, ended up being a live scorpion, which he captured. Got that to me at the diagnostic lab. I have been working to track down the appropriate keys to figure out the exact species, and that will help narrow down where it might have come from in the world. But we still don't know the source at this point. In my career at the diagnostic lab over the last decade, I've maybe seen, I think this is probably my third case of a scorpion ever. I've seen them, you know, a dead crushed one that came in a shipment of automobile parts from Central America, another one that came in a shipment of produce. These scorpions, they're not things that we have in Wisconsin. They originate elsewhere, and they get here one way or another, hitchhiking or, you know, getting back in some sort of material or being shipped around. It's not any sort of thing that I feel is a threat that's going to, you know, start popping up here more regularly. I think it's just one of these odd things that surfaces from time to time.
Okay. Dennis, thanks for calling. Bob in Iola, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, great respect for your knowledge. I took some bug courses in college, and you so far surpassed what I know. So here's the question. I've got a Cecropia moth, and the first one I've seen in 40 years. I have an organic farm in the central part of the state, and it's dead already. Where's it at in its life cycle? And two, how far do the drift from these synthetic chemicals from neighbors come to kill these moths.
Yeah, is it an adult moth, or was it an adult moth?
Adult.
Okay.
So it's, I guess it's just emerged. It was still moving one or two of its legs. It was laying under a plum tree, classic habitat, okay. But dead.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, hard to tell exactly what would have happened in this case. I mean, the adult Cecropia moths and some of the relatives like Polyphemus and Luna moth, the adults generally don't live very long at all. It might be less than a week. So they come out, it's kind of a mad dash to try and find a mate. And if you think about it, you know, a Cecropia moth, that's one of our largest moths. And so that would make a really swell meal for a bat or something like that, which is probably part of the reason why they have such short adult lifespans. So, you know, if you had observed it emerging and it just fell down dead, hard to tell what might have gone on, but if it had been just found dead and it might have been alive for a couple of days, often those are going to have perhaps more tattered wings, but it might have just reached the end of its adult lifespan.
There you go, Bob. Thank you for calling. Oh, and in terms of drift?
Oh, the drift. Yeah, that's a great question and really hard to tell. I mean, with drift, a few factors can be at play that can include things like what was the wind speed at the time of application. A key factor is how high above a crop or a plant a pesticide is applied. In general, the lower you are and closer you are to a crop, the chance for drift is going to be reduced versus if you were up higher or if it were, say, an aerial application from, you know, aircraft or something like that, there's at least a possibility, greater chance of drift. Wind speed is going to play a role in that as well, but it's hard for me to give any sort of firm numbers in terms of distances for how far it would drift.
Carol in Waukesha emailed us to ask about chigger bites. They have gotten these mid-summer when it's been hot and dry, but not lately. Are there fewer chiggers?
Oh, that's a tough question. It's always hard to tell with chiggers because by the time you notice the bites, the actual chiggers may not be present any longer. However, I will say the last two or so years at the diagnostic lab, I have seen more cases that fit the profile for classic chigger cases than I ever have before. I suspect with drier conditions the last couple of years, it's been really conducive for them. And if things stay rainy this year, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw fewer this summer.
John in Shatek emailed to ask about the mature box elder bugs they're seeing all over the place this spring. John says he's never seen so many, and then one day they were all gone.
Well, a reason you're probably seeing so many would be the weather last year. Box elder bugs, like some of the other insects we talked about today, can do very well when you have dry conditions. And with box elder bugs in the state, they can actually go through two generations per year. So have a spring one, and then we get another generation later on in the summer. And if you have dry conditions throughout that, and they are able to increase their numbers very high, that would explain why we've seen so many kind of statewide the last year or two. Compared to 10 years ago, I just wasn't seeing that many of them when we had some rainier years. So their numbers have definitely been up. But it's also interesting. You can have them on the side of a structure, and then they're there one day and seemingly gone the next. That just seems to be the pattern with these.
Sabina and Nina, I think we might have lost her. She has a peach tree in her yard, and her leaves on the peach tree, there are bumps on the leaves. That's all I've got from that, and I'm not sure.
Okay. In a case like this, Sabina, if you are catching this, I would recommend taking a couple of photos of that and emailing it to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Simply hearing about the bumps on the leaves, I suspect it might be galls, and galls are these unusual plant growths and the response to a stimulus that can be mites at times, that could be aphids and other insects. There's even diseases that can cause that, but these can be really pretty common on related plants like plums, where you get these little projections coming out of the leaf. It looks odd, but it really doesn't affect plant health at all. So that's perhaps some good news. But if you send me some photos, I should be able to tell if they are indeed galls and if they are, narrowed down the type and what creature caused it.
Brad emailed us a photo of an American carrion beetle on a snake. It's a fairly large, looks like a fairly long snake with a carrion beetle on it. And he's not something he's never seen before and wonders if you have any insight on that.
Yeah, so these American carrion beetles, they're relatively large beetles, mostly black, but they have a region called the pronotum. It's essentially their neck region, if you will, Larry, and it's kind of this broad shield-like area that tends to be yellow with a blackish spot in the middle. And overall, these insects can be really quite common if you know when and where to look for them, and they essentially love dead, smelly stuff. So if you've got roadkill or something dead in your yard, these tend to find it very, very quickly. And they're really quite beneficial in terms of what they do. These and other insects will very quickly colonize an animal that has died, the remains that are there, and then they use it as a food source to be able to raise their young. So kind of nature's garbage men or recyclers, if you will.
Jane and Edgerton emailed a photo of a beautiful moth on their irises. And she'd like some help in identifying it and also wants to know an app you would recommend for identifying insects.
Yeah, so the moth in the photo that was sent in, this is the white-lined sphinx moth, which can be a really common species overall. I often see many of these later in the summer, but I will say in the last month or so, I've had quite a few pictures of the caterpillar. So I wonder if we might be in store for a good year. We'll have to stay tuned in late July and August to see if that comes to be. But it's a very common, really cool moth. Large wingspan. The adults are often mistaken for hummingbirds because of their behavior. And in terms of an app, there's one that I happen to be pretty fond of. It's associated with the website called iNaturalist. And this is an app called Seek, S-E-E-K. And it can do a pretty good job at identifying insects with a couple of caveats. I mean, it only identifies things or tries to identify things. It'll show a series of color-coded dots. The more dots, the better it's done in terms of narrowing things down. And so it might only be able to identify something to family level in some cases because maybe the insect's small or hard to see. From my experience, it tends to work better for more two-dimensional type things like moths or butterflies versus small creatures. And also, I do see the app make errors on a somewhat regular basis, especially at species level. So take that with a grain of salt. Anytime I use that app, I then do some digging and see, does that species actually occur in Wisconsin? Is the time of the year right? And start cross-checking some of these other things. But it is a fun app to play with.
But you already know before you even take the picture.
In a lot of cases, yes. I still see plenty of things where, you know, I have a pretty good idea of what it is. And if I'm out in my yard and I just want to, you know, kind of narrow it down a little bit quickly, I have been known to pull out that app myself.
PJ, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit. PJ Leash, our guest today, he's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him with us. I wanted to mention just quickly, tomorrow at noon, we will be talking about sustainable urban design from noon to one with a research associate with UW's Department of Planning and Landscaping at UW-Madison, kind of to go along with our book of the month book that we will be offering. And coming up, we'll be talking with a couple of DNR invasive species specialists about efforts statewide to help native plants, animals, and habitat thrive. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, all over Wisconsin, people work to remove invasive woody plants and restore prairies and wetlands with more diverse native flora. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the important work individuals and groups are doing to protect native habitat. And a couple of guests for you. Mackenzie Manicky is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR focused on terrestrial invasive plants. Mackenzie is a facilitator of the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council, organizer of the council's annual Invasive Species Action Awards. Mackenzie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us today is one of this year's award winners, Jason Granberg, invasive plant specialist, project coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. And Jason, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
And I hope you'll join in. You, how are you sharing the battle with invasive species? Do you need advice for maybe getting rid of your buckthorn or garlic musters, or maybe help identifying what an invasive species is and isn't? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Mackenzie, let's start with you. June is Invasive Species Action Month. Why is it important this time of the year to draw attention to the spread of invasive plants?
So June is a beautiful month. People are out and about, out on boats or out hiking in natural areas. And so it's a great time of year to start thinking about how to prevent the spread of invasive species. So Action Month is a great time to think about cleaning off your equipment after you're recreating outdoors, making sure you're not spreading seeds or other invasive organisms from site to site, so you can help preserve those places that you recreate in the long term.
And you help facilitate the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council, and you organize the council's annual Invasive Species Action Awards. What impact are the people receiving these awards having on protecting our native habitat?
So we're really humbled and I'm grateful and proud of all of the nominations that we receive every year. There's a lot of, all the nominations are always fantastic. It's always a challenge to narrow it down for our winners. So we're really lucky in that way. But overall, a lot of the winners have spent a lot of time, a lot of effort in a variety of ways on efforts to educate or remove invasive species or otherwise prevent their spread. So they're often leaders in their areas. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, Jason, let's turn to you. This month you received one of the awards for playing a sort of a, I would say, behind-the-scenes role coordinating statewide efforts to fight invasive species. What specifically do you do to support those efforts?
So like you said, I'm behind the scenes. I do lots of support work. Things that I do is I find grant opportunities. I write and administer grants. And then we use those funds. We disperse them to some of our DNR properties, like our state natural areas, and then also to one of our primary partners, which are the Cooperative Invasive Species Management Areas. These are NGOs that help out with invasive species topics. I also do things. I work with databases. I compile maps. I work with climate change analyses to figure out what new species we're going to encounter in the future. And then I also do some other administrative things too. We're working on a rule revision to NR40, which is a Wisconsin Invasive Species Council project, and we're working to revise that species list.
Well, that's a lot. You're doing a lot there, and you're definitely deserving of this award. I had some callers online with some questions that relate to invasive species, and let's go to Glenn in Waupaca. What's on your mind, Glenn?
Well, thank you for taking my call. You know, it seems like a futile attempt fighting these invasive species such as garlic, mustard, and buckthorn. And we fight the garlic mustard on our half-mile trail we have mowed. We pick as much as we can along the trail, but it seems such a futile attempt. Is there anything that we can do to fight the buckthorn in our yard and also the garlic mustard?
There's some interesting things that are coming out with research regarding garlic mustard. One idea is that with some of these garlic mustard patches, if they're in the area for long enough, they create an environment around themselves that make them more susceptible to pathogens. And so for these large populations, they tend to, sometimes they'll die out on their own. There's also interesting information about a biocontrol effort to look at different aphid species and how they can impact garlic mustard. One of them is called grenade aphid. They look like the World War I pineapple grenades. And so people are watching to see what kinds of these native aphids that we have that will best control those on their own. With buckthorns, that's going to be a bit more of a difficult challenge because of how prolific they are in the state. One of the best things that we have for these species that are so widespread is to find locations where they're first emerging in the landscape, try and deal with them as an early detection species, and then try to work back towards a large source population. But unfortunately, without a lot of finance and effort and labor, it's hard to control buckthorns.
Yeah. And when they get big, when they get large, they're tough to get out, for sure. I was looking online at some mechanical removers, things that a person can use by himself or herself to kind of pull them out by the roots.
Yeah, there's an interesting tool called a weed wrench. So you're using physics to really have a lever that's below the surface of the soil, and you can rip the whole thing out.
Oh my goodness me. Glenn, there you go. Thank you. Phyllis in town of Dunn, we'll go to you.
Hi. So I'm from out east, and there my hometown is just covered with lesser celandine. And then this year, or actually a couple years ago, I saw it in my lawn here. And this year I covered up three patches with, I pulled them out, and then I covered up with cardboard. And, so far, so good. But is lesser celandine much around here? I haven't seen it anywhere around here except for in my yard.
So that's a great question. So lesser celandine is actually considered a prohibited species under the Wisconsin's invasive species rule. And prohibited species are those that exist in small isolated populations in the state or they're not yet present. So they're a real focus for early detection and rapid response efforts. So if you do find lesser celandine or other prohibited species on your land, we ask that you try to control them so they don't spread further and cause further impacts. Early detection and rapid response is the best way to get a handle on invasive species before they get out of hand, like garlic mustard or buckthorns.
Celandine. Okay. Phyllis, it sounds like you've got a good start on getting it under control, and you really need to do it. So good for you. And Helen in Big Bend, your turn. Hi, Helen.
We have some golden oyster mushrooms, and I think I saw some place where they are invasive, but we really enjoy eating them. And I was wondering how we should care for them, if they're going to spread or if they're going to be a nuisance, or and how late into their season can you eat them?
Oh, well, I don't know. Mackenzie, do you know anything about, are they invasive, golden oyster mushrooms?
I don't know much about mushrooms in general. I don't believe there are any invasive mushrooms listed under the rule, but I would have to check to be sure on that. Jason, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I don't have any other information about the golden oyster mushrooms or if they are invasive in our area.
Yeah, I've never heard of them being called invasive either, but of course I'm no expert at all. So there you go, Helen. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Another professional award winner, I want to get back to that for a few minutes. We've got a lot of them. Jeb Barzin was a professional award winner, and Jeb's been a guest on this program many times. To talk about eagles and all kinds of other things, and I'm glad to see that he's also Jason. What is he works with farmers, doesn't he?
Yeah, I was looking up some information about his program and what he's been doing. And so it looks like it's part of a some ecological restoration to help with fostering native plants around potato farming areas.
Very cool. Very cool. He's got a healthy grow program, I think is what he calls it. And it was cool for me to see him getting this award, because I know he's done so much work, especially with eagles and with other birds as well here in the state. John in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, this is very timely because I have a small prairie I'm trying to establish. You know, it's like maybe 10 by 30 or 15 by 30. And I was just digging out fleabane today, which I'm trying to, I don't want in there. And then I also noticed I'm having some, it looks like heated as being timothy grass. And, you know, it's got like a long cylindrical seed head. It's like a giant pencil eraser. And I'm just wondering if that's going to take over. If I don't dig it out, will it take over my little prairie?
So as far as the timothy grass goes, I'm not super familiar with it, but I have had one question about it in the past. And I did a little research on it a while ago, and it seems like it's more of a problem in grasslands out west. But I haven't seen much about it being an issue in Wisconsin. Or Jason, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, also with timothy grass, I agree. It's more of a western rangeland kind of problem. And with your prairie that you're starting to establish, just remember that prairies are these intermediate disturbance ecosystems. So occasional disruptions like using prescribed fire will help knock back non-native plants, and then also help your locally adapted native plants to thrive.
Yeah. John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, we are having some fun here talking about some award winners and invasive plants as well with our two guests today, Mackenzie Manicky. Mackenzie Manicky is a conservation biologist with the DNR. Jason Granberg is an invasive plant specialist and project coordinator for the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at invasive plants with our two guests today, and also talking about some honors and awards some of them have received for the work that they've done in our state to remove invasive plants. Our guest, Mackenzie Manicky, conservation biologist with DNR, Jason Granberg is invasive plant specialist and project coordinator for the DNR. So wonderful to have them with us. I did want to mention some other winners from the event. John Mariani has, I guess, single-handedly removed thousands of exotic invasives to restore, it was about 60 acres of oak and savanna near Burlington.
Yeah, that's correct. It seems like he's also started his own landscape design business and has started educating and showing others on the importance and versatility of using native plants in landscaping as well. Native plants are a great addition to your landscaping, and they coexist well together and don't get out of hand in the same way that invasives can.
Yeah, absolutely. Marlene in Wales, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I've got an area in my yard that, with some advice from a local nature center in years past, we got out some of the real invasive things like buckthorn and burdock. And I did plant a few natives that I bought through them, but they no longer have that service. And I'm trying to figure out who I can go to look at this area and say, yeah, oh, look, those trilliums are really propagating nicely. Let's not plant something near them, you know, that's going to give them too much shade or not enough or whatever. Like, how do I create a wild native flower bed in a woodland setting?
That's a really great question. There are lots of resources on the DNR website. We have a Plant Native Plants page that has a variety of resources there for restoring natural areas and also landscaping resources. And on that page, there are a couple of lists. One of them is a list of restoration contractors that's regional, so you can find people in your area. And there's also a list of native plant nurseries as well that you can find there. So they would have great information, I'm sure.
Yes, they would indeed. So go to the DNR website?
Yeah, on the DNR website, and then in the search bar, enter in plant native plants. And it should be the first thing that pops up there. And like I said, lots of great resources.
Yeah, Marlene, there you go. Thank you. Susan in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I have had increasing growth of thistles over the years. I used to have a few thistles, and I would try to dig them out, or I would try Roundup, but nothing ever worked. And I understand there is some kind of method of destroying thistles permanently, but I don't know what it is or where to find it.
Do you know what, is it a Canada thistle?
Well, it has a purple flower.
Yeah. So we have lots of different thistle species that are in Wisconsin, and they will all typically respond to the same control activities. One of our favorite resources that we use and we reference and send people to is, it's the Renz Weed Science Lab. So R-E-N-Z, Weed Science. And there, within that page, there are lots of different tools. One of them is their invasive plant management fact sheets. And that can give you an idea of what kinds of herbicides are going to be most effective towards controlling your thistles.
Yeah, Canada thistles are really awful. I think they are very, very hard to get rid of. Some are relatively easy, but I'm thinking Susan may have some Canada thistles there, and those are difficult. So you might want to take a look online at Canada thistle and see if that's what you've got, Susan, and there are probably heavier duty control measures for those as well. Kyle in Winneconne, your turn. Hi, Kyle.
Hello, Larry and guests. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have these ornamental bushes in my front. I recently used an app to identify them, and it says they're like Japanese barberry, and it says they're invasive. I was wondering if you guys could confirm that or know anything about them.
Japanese barberry, are they invasive? Okay.
Yes, Japanese barberry is an invasive plant that we have. We've got common barberry and Japanese barberry. One of the ways that you can tell them apart is a common barberry will have three little spines, and the Japanese barberry will have one. And then if you're also looking at the leaf, it kind of looks like a ping pong paddle. It's kind of oval-shaped. One of the important reasons why you would want to have your barberry be controlled, not only can they cause issues for the natural areas, but they can also be hosts to rodents, which can then carry ticks, and those ticks can then carry Lyme disease.
Oh. So how do we go through that again? How do I identify which one is the bad one?
Well, they're both bad.
Yeah.
So common barberry and Japanese barberry are both bad. Common barberry will have three little thorns, while Japanese barberry will only have one, okay. And they will have a similar leaf shape.
Okay. Kyle, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mona in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mona.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk about our attempts at getting rid of garlic mustard in our backyard. I think we've nailed it, I hope. But I want your opinion and your guest's opinion. What we did is the last couple of years, we've had our gardener pull all the garlic mustard she can get to. And then she puts corn gluten meal on top of them so they don't spread any more seeds. And then she covers them with either burlap sacks or cardboard, and then we put about 3 inches of mulch on top. Do you think that's going to work?
Yeah, I mean, pulling is one of the really effective ways to start getting garlic mustard off of your landscape. And I think that covering it or smothering it in that manner that you described is also going to help prevent seedlings from coming up in the future. So hopefully you've ensured a little bit longer term effective control on that.
Yeah, I think that's sounded pretty good to me. Mona, thank you for calling. Dennis in Afton, Minnesota, will give you a chance now. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, hi. Thanks very much, guests, Larry, and everyone who works for WPR. I appreciate it. I saw a publication produced by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources a while back claiming some indications of, through research, some success with taking buckthorn and cutting it off up at 4 foot high, and then stripping all the branches off. I'm wondering if you have any success or awareness of that approach. And secondly, in our neighborhood, we've got a patch of Japanese knotweed, and we're putting together a team effort here, hopefully to come up with a non-chemical approach to we have to deal with it. So thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. So buckthorn, cutting it off 3 feet up and then stripping all the bark off of it?
I have not heard of that as a control method, cutting it up at 4 feet tall and then taking the limbs off. So that's interesting. It's something I'll have to look into. But cut stump methods, usually cutting the stem a few inches above the ground and then treating the stump with some herbicide is a really common way for controlling woody species and buckthorn.
Yeah, it needs to be done. I think that application needs to be done right away as you make the cut.
That's the most effective way. People also do what's called girdling. So you can take a ring of bark off across the circumference of the stem, and then you can leave it like that. Otherwise, you can treat it with a little bit of herbicide as well to ensure a little bit better results, too.
What about Japanese knotweed? Dennis mentioned that.
Typically, with Japanese knotweed, what we found is that mechanical control really doesn't work, and people have had concerns about herbicides. That's understandable. But with some species, herbicide may be the best option that we have available. If you want to limit the amount of herbicide that you use, there's a tool for Japanese knotweed control, and it's a stem injector. And so what you're doing is that the knotweed has these hollow tubes that are kind of stacked together, and the stem injector will, you can inject it into that, and then you can add a small amount of herbicide. So you're not doing a foliar spray, you're not aerosolizing the herbicide. You're doing a small directed application to those nodes.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it, and certainly a safer way for the other plants. I should mention on Garden Talk coming up on Friday, we're going to be talking about native plants. Native plants have come up a bit here today in this last time period here, and we'll talk natives and pollinators on Friday's program as well. So how are these, Mackenzie, how are the winners or recipients, I should say, of the awards, how are they honored?
So each year, each June, the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council and partners host the Invasive Species Action Awards. The location moves around the state, so we have an awards ceremony where each recipient is given an awards plaque. The plaques are very interesting and cool in that they're made from wood that was taken from ash trees that had to be felled due to emerald ash borer, which is an invasive insect in Wisconsin. So it's kind of tied all together in the invasives world. But we have these cool plaques, and we have a nice ceremony, and the council congratulates and thanks all of the recipients for their efforts.
Yeah, and there were, how many were there this year? There were
13 this year, yes.
13 recipients. Great to have them recognized. I looked at their work, and it looks absolutely amazing, and it tired me out just to look and read about all the work that they did. Mackenzie, Jason, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it very much, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Mackenzie Manicky of the DNR, Jason Granberg of the DNR as well, our guests. And thank you very much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mueller.